After World War II, Britain began work on its independent nuclear deterrent, building on Nazi technology seized at the end of World War II. Over time, this would spawn a successful space program that by 1971 was launching rockets into space. Today, we're going to talk about that forgotten British and Australian space program. Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards, and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favourite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern, and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not-so-famous moments in history from all across the globe. In 1971, a British rocket launched from Australia carried a satellite into geostationary orbit. On that day, Britain became the fourth nation in history to achieve this feat of scientific and engineering genius. On the same day, it became the first nation to cancel its independent space program entirely. Today, we'll be talking about Britain, Australia, and the space race, and the traces of this forgotten achievement that can still be found today. And to do that with me is Associate Professor Alice Gorman, space archaeologist at Flinders University, Adelaide, and author of the book Dr. Space Junk vs. the Universe, Archaeology and the Future. Asteroid 551014, I think they've got right, they got that right, is your asteroid.
That's my asteroid.
Gorman, that is your asteroid, is named after her in recognition of her work in establishing space archaeology. It is an absolute honour to have you on the show today, Alice.
It's fantastic to be here, Gareth. And I'm very excited to discuss the theme of this program.
Yeah, I think I have always been fascinated with this as a space program and as the legacy and the little impacts it's left on both Britain and Australia that actually just are so forgotten now. They're just not seen.
It's really interesting. The US has taken over the space narrative of the world. Private corporations are similarly, you know, quite keen to make their mark, to not always acknowledge what happened in the past. And I think both Australia and Britain have lost, people have forgotten what happened. They've forgotten in the 1950s, 60s, well, going from the 1940s, I think the first rocket launches at one were in 1950s, but through the 60s and 70s, Australia and the UK were players in the space club with all of this exciting stuff happening. And it does, as you said, it's got a legacy. There are resonances today. And I think it's really useful to go back to them.
I think 100%. And so to set the scene, listeners, Alice touched on it there. This really is a story that begins in the aftermath of World War II. And we're reasonably familiar. In fact, we talked on an earlier podcast episode when we talked about rat lines and escaping Nazis. I think as a society, if you're into history, you're probably reasonably familiar with the idea of Operation Paperclip, which is this operation that starts in 1945, in which the US program of getting Nazi rocket scientists and engineers and their families over to the US in order to kickstart their own development of what is a missile program that will eventually lead into the space race. But people forget that they weren't the only ones doing that. The Soviets were doing it well, but so were the British, weren't they?
And the French. People tend to forget that as well.
Yeah.
So we know there were sort of the four allies who carved up various bits of Europe and other places. But all of them, Project Paperclip, Operation Backfire, France and USSR were all trying to get the technology. And for all of them, it was an absolute game changer. Taking that V2 rocket, which was a weapon, developing it into more weapons, and almost as an afterthought, really, developing it into a rocket that could launch satellites into space. As satellites started to become the big business, the only game in town.
And that's really where we're leading up to, is, and we'll get there over the course of this. But I think, listeners, bear that in mind as we're talking about this, that the goal here, certainly at this stage for everyone, people aren't necessarily thinking about manned spaceflight at this point. It really is about putting satellites into space becomes the driver of those early civilian space programs really early on. Now, Alice, as you mentioned, Operation Backfire is the key thing here. And Backfire is incredible. I highly recommend it. Listeners, you will not have heard of Operation Backfire. I'm going to place a strong bet on that. But this is effectively the British equivalent of Operation Paperclip. And it's their effort, the British effort, to turn around and go, actually, let's identify some of these key figures in rocketry, in German rocketry, and let's try and bring them back. And there's some fantastic photos of this online from one of the officers involved, who's, I think it's Frank Micklethwaite, who's got them. We'll share some in the notes. But effectively, what the British do is they look at what the Americans are doing, and they realize they can't really get that level of scientist. There's a fantastic quote from Wernher von Braun about how we despised the French, feared the Russians, and the British couldn't afford us, which I think is very on point. But yeah, I mean, backfire is this operation, isn't it, where we're effectively taking these V2 rockets. Britain focuses very much on the people who are launching them, the engineering side, rather than the scientists. And that starts to define out the British and the later the joint with Australia program, doesn't it?
Well, because they get the scientists, that everybody knows what the technology is by that stage. So, and, you know, London had very up close and personal with the bombardment from V1s and V2s. So this is an interesting resonance, I think, for the way the UK space program starts, because they had really been bombarded by these weapons and are now turning around and saying to the personnel, actually, come with us. We actually want you to help us make more of these. So it's sort of rich with irony and all of that sort of thing. But of course, the problem is, if you want to launch rockets and missiles of any kind, and at this stage, you know, we think of rockets as space rocket, moon rocket, but they're missiles. These are weapons. You need a long launch range. And Britain isn't, it's just not that big. Launch oversea is a lot of it. The early rocket launches were launched oversea. The problem is you have to recover it then as well. So Britain's looking for a long launch range where it can launch these missiles and rockets and have them not come down over populated areas, which is kind of, you know, most of the UK. So this is where the colonies suddenly become really interesting. The colonies and...
Well, let's pay our first visit to Australia now, because as you say, this is right from the word go, right from 1946 when this operation's underway. Australia is part of this. So yeah, take us to Australia. And I'm going to inevitably pronounce this wrong. I'm going to go with Woomera.
Oh, very well done. So the side of Woomera, I'll talk a little bit more about that. So Australia had to offer. It is, to this day, the British monarch is the head of Australian state, to this day. Back then, relationships were much, much closer politically, I think. So a long baseline launch line was needed, low population was needed, and political stability, stable weather, ability to retrieve rockets, all of these things, and Australia had them all, plus a willingness to collaborate. And for Australia, this was a big deal, because I'm going to step back a little bit and talk about more ironies in the political relationship between Australia and the UK. So Australia had, my interpretation of this history, a huge fear of abandonment. And this goes right back to the 1850s Russian scare. That's a whole story in itself. Then First World War, Gallipoli. Then Second World War, invasion of Japan. Australia would have been lost. And this, it's at this point Australia turns to the US as a political ally, because the UK government just said, get stuffed. We're keeping your troops. Australia can fall to the Japanese for all we care. And so the US stepped in. So the promise of weapons that could be used to defend Australia against what became communist Southeast Asia is hugely attractive. So it's at this point that Australia and the UK conceive of this joint project to develop weapons at Woomera. And so let's talk about Woomera, because it's an extraordinary place, and I hope we have time for me to describe it to you. As a place.
Go for it.
So Woomera is located in sort of northwest of South Australia. It's often called, you know, desert. And it's sort of geographically, I guess, desert in terms of the rainfall it gets and what it can support in terms of European agriculture. And it is quite far from everything, which was one of its draw cards that nobody, and this is the other big part of this story, nobody except a few pesky Aboriginal people would get hurt. Also, there were settlers, landholders as well, but, you know, pretty sparse, so sheep and Aboriginal people. So there's a famous story of a plane trip that was taken in 1946, I think, with the sort of UK top brass. They're flying over that region of South Australia, which actually sort of goes right up to the border with the Northern Territory in Western Australia, and it's red desert sand. So this is an unpopulated area, they say, as it appeared to be, and the red sands of Woomera reflect the white sands of the US primary missile and nuclear testing site. And I'll just drop in here. Of course, British nuclear testing took place adjacent to Woomera at Maralinga and Emu Field. So all of the same reasons these places were attractive, weapons testing. So there's this idea that they'll call it red sands. But somewhere in here emerges the idea that they'll call it the town they established and the region, they would call it Woomera. It didn't have this name before. A Woomera is a spear thrower. So it's a wooden device. You fit the end of a spear into it and you throw the handle, increasing the velocity of the spear. So Woomera is...
I remember seeing some when I was over in the museum. I was over in Sydney a few years back and they got some lovely ones, like examples of them in the Sydney Museum. So if you've not seen one and you live in Sydney and you're a listener, get yourself down to the National Museum. There's some good examples there.
So the whole name is a metaphor for rocket launch. An agreement is signed. So Australia is going to develop missiles and there were other things as well, planes and radar and a whole bunch of stuff, but this was the primary one. So they set up the prohibited area. So in the prohibited area, you couldn't go there. So this is very different to in the US where people could see rocket launches, you know, the Space Coast, Cape Canaveral, people can see launches. In Australia, you can't see them. You have to drive a very long way. So they're not visible. The general population doesn't sort of have any sense of what's happening out there. And in the 60s, Woomera was, in fact, after Cape Canaveral, the busiest launch site in the world, 24-hour cadence, continuous launches. And it gets named. They start to build a town. And a story I love about the town is all the street names are Aboriginal words. And it's all military as well. So it's a defense town. And there's some consternation about how postal deliveries will be made with these bizarre street names. So whoever the sort of military postmaster was said, look, you've got to change them. Just give them numbers. Give all the streets numbers. None of this. The postie won't know where to go. How is he going to distinguish? And to their credit, the Australian top brass said, get stuffed, we're keeping it. So Woomera, all the street names are in Woomera. So you have this town springs up out of nowhere in the desert. And I have to say
I'm fascinated by that, mm-hmm. just to pause on that, is that so I've done a lot of work looking at the Royal Navy and how the Royal Navy looks at naming conventions and how they name things. And what you just said there strikes an interesting chord with me, because in various points when the Royal Navy are building classes of ship, particularly in pre-war and going into after the war, and these are ships actually the Australians end up building as well, the Tribal and Daring class of destroyers. The last example of the Daring class in the world is again in Sydney Harbour. It's well worth a visit. But is that they put a lot of effort into looking at what they name them for places and tribes around the empire. So you end up with them named after like HMS Hyder. And they're named after, they look to almost go, we want to try and make these elements of the community, even though we're imposing these things on them, we want to make some kind of a thing of saying that we want them to feel part of it. Now, it's very heavy-handed and it's not good, but you talking about the street names has just reminded me of that and makes me think that actually clearly some element of the Australian military establishment was maybe doing the same thing.
Yes, I think it's, as a landscape, they're kind of, they can make everything from scratch because there's no infrastructure out there, but they're very deliberately creating the landscape as an Indigenous landscape. So it's very ironic because, of course, you know, the assumption is that Aboriginal people who live there aren't going to mind or are on the way out. They're in the process of dying out. That was the prevalent belief at the time. So taking on that identity is actually really quite interesting, I think. But Gareth, I did want to point out, I can't help it, I'm sorry, the entire UK can fit inside the part of Woomera that's in South Australia, and it actually extends into Western Australia. All of the UK can fit inside it. I just have to point that out to give you a visual sense of what we're talking about.
But that's huge, and we'll return. I think that's a great place to temporarily leave it and head back to the UK, because I think you've just established there the scale of this and the importance of it. And as you mentioned earlier, one of the things that there's a lot of, when we talk, how do we get from taking these scientists through to actually having a program? So listeners, think of what you start with is you start with a unit within the British Army that's composed of these engineers. And I'm going to absolutely butcher this, and I apologize to German listeners. It's actually called the Altenwalder Versuchskommando. And it's this mixed unit of British and German troops that do these launches. And they're launching them out initially over the Baltic. As Alice said, they're bringing these V2s back and they're bringing them to the UK. And so as well as this facility in Australia for the launches, you have testing facilities and things in the UK. And these, the two most kind of almost iconic of these are RAF Spadaddon, which is in Cumbria, and then also the Isle of Wight, where we test some of these rockets. And this is almost a bit where I want to maybe pause for a second and talk. We've discussed three sites here, effectively. You're a space archaeologist. Like, what is the modern state of things like preserving sites like that? How do we even approach that?
Oh, that's such a great question, because I think they're so important as places where this technology developed, places with that political importance for the future of peace and war. And they're also, in sort of heritage terms, they're ugly. They're not stately homes or beautiful buildings. They're industrial, they're military, they're concrete. They're often hard to recognize. If you don't know what you're looking at, you wouldn't know without more context. So it's a very specific type of heritage that does require specific consideration. The UK does pretty well on this. So some of my colleagues, Wayne Cockcroft and John Schofield, Roger Thomas and others, have looked at the Cold War heritage of the British Isles and Second World War, all of the Cold War stuff, nuclear defence stuff. So there is a recognition that this is important and these places are important. But of course, you know, they're often in poor condition and expensive to maintain or restore. And often I think something you said before is really important as well. One of the most critical things in ensuring that something, you know, isn't just bulldozed because people don't know what it is that memory in the community, is the community around it, the people who live in that place who remember what those tank traps were for. We have them in Australia, and I'm sure you've got them in the UK, weird concrete triangles that were actually meant to deter tanks. And that you know, they're getting rarer because people don't always know what they are. But those memories are still, they're in the community, the places where people live. They know about these things. And that's, I think, one of the most critical things in preserving this heritage of peace and war, which goes right up to the present.
And to touch on the engineering side here for listeners, the kind of rocketry we're talking about here, and rocketry is a vast and complex science and everything else, is you might have images in your head of sort of Saturn rockets and, you know, the big US rockets with these solid state fuel engines burning out vast amounts of fuel and flame as they soar into the air. Now, what I always find fascinating about this program is it's almost the program that's had more influence on modern rocketry in a way, because what they do is they take that initial V2 technology, which isn't really based on that solid fuel element, and they look to develop that out. It's more based on something called high-test peroxide rocketry, which is where you're taking hydrogen peroxide, you're combining it with water, and that's effectively creating incredibly high-pressure steam. And you then either use just that, or you combine it with something like paraffin or another accelerant, and that creates the enormous amount of thrusts that push these rockets into the air. And the British, working with the Australians, start to perfect this technology as we move through the 50s and into the 60s, in parallel with the US developing out their big rockets. And they're doing that to a certain extent because it's a lot cheaper, isn't it?
Which is a really interesting point, I think. If you look at the US space program, it's high profile, it's wealthy compared to what we're looking at in Australia and the UK. And a saying that was, you know, not uncommon, there's versions of the kind of thing, necessity is the mother of invention, were often thrown around in the UK Australian space program, because people were trying to do fantastic technological things by being a bit creative about it, because they didn't have to build another V2 or a Saturn V. And I think that technology is really, really interesting.
And there's, again, like returning briefly to Australia, we still get legacies of that. I remember you and I chatting before, there's 17 V2s left in the world, you told me. And like, Australia's got some of them, hasn't it?
We have two of them. So something that Britain did as part of this program was to send V2s over to Woomera. And there's some wonderful pictures, like graphical representations of these rockets coming on boats across the sea to arrive in Australia. But they weren't really used. And there's two that are intact. They're both now in the military museum, in Australian War Memorial Museum in Canberra. One of them was a display model, which you opened up the sort of nose cone in order to see the workings inside. So it was never intended to be launched, and coloured wires and all kinds of stuff. There's some amazing pictures of it in Martin Place in the centre of Sydney, with people clustered around. I think it was late 40s. People clustered around to look inside this rocket to see how it worked. And the other one ended up at the Point Cook RAF base, and was getting a little bit, it was at the entrance and weather was affecting it. So the War Memorial took it over. So we have these two V2s left. And I think, Gareth, thinking of some of your thoughts on this, so those rockets, the V2, they're the classic rocket shape, almost fish shape. They're curvy, a little bit curvy, and kind of a little bit beautiful, even though they're weapons of death and destruction. But the way rockets develop from them doesn't necessarily go down that path. And one of the most interesting looking rockets, and I always get these names mixed up, it's either the Black Knight or the Black Arrow, that's called the lipstick rocket, because it's sort of a straight cylinder, and then the nose cone sort of curves up to a point, and it's painted red as if it were a lipstick that you were just going to wind up. And it didn't, the pictures of it look weird because there's no fire or gas or anything. It was sort of exhaustless, and it rose up into the sky. So the pictures look wrong to people because they can't understand how it's suspended. But it's visually, it's such an interesting rocket to me.
Yeah, and it's Black Arrow. It's Black Arrow. And this is actually a really good opportunity to talk about how these rockets develop. Because as we say, they're powered by this high-test peroxide combos. Black Arrow, by the time it's made, is about, I think they combine it with paraffin to create a dual propellant model or a bipropellant model. And these rockets, they do look weird. If you see photos of them now, they look, because you just don't have the plume of smoke and the fire that we're used to from solid state rockets. But they worked and they were brilliant. And the development really kicks in properly in around about 1953, with all of this starting to come together and the engineering coming together. And as we talked already about, this is a missile program to begin with. So the early side of this is actually, it really starts to come together with the creation of something called Blue Streak, which is a medium range ballistic missile pulled together by the British. Now, what ultimately ends up happening, this is again tested in Australia, is it's tested. The process on how this tends to work is these rockets get tested on the gantry at RAF Spade Adam in Cumbria. They then get moved to the Isle of Wight for engine testing, and you get these fantastic photos of these engine plumes extending out against the needles in Isle of Wight. And then, as you say, they're shipped over to Australia for launch or firing or final testing. And by 1953, you've got Blue Streak as a very successful missile. One of my favorite anecdotes about it, though, and this is the problem with high-test peroxide rocketry, is it doesn't react very well to de-icer, which, when you're launching these things from Vulcan bombers based in Scotland, causes certain amounts of issues, because there's a fantastic thing I found in various papers, which highlights that for a significant amount of the operational life of the Blue Streak nuclear missile, which was launched from Vulcan bombers, the rules were that it was allowed to have a warhead or fuel, but never both at the same time. Which is just the most British bit ever. But so this ultimately, though, as time goes on, and it ties in a bit with what you were saying earlier, is that you get this greater alignment from Britain as much as Australia with the US and with the US programs, which is so much money in. And without going into detail here, what starts to happen is Britain starts to align its military aspects more with US rocketry. So its independent missile program starts to be less important. And so what happens is that then gets moved into being a civilian program, which is where we get these, what called the black rockets, the Black Knight and the Black Arrow. And those are the ones that really start to begin that civilian program in Australia and Britain, aren't they?
Well, I have to say something here about names and words, which we've already alluded to. I think there's some really interesting cultural differences in how people name things. And something the British names for rockets and missiles and various things are somehow one-dimensional, in that you don't get a strong visual sense, or you don't get a strong sense of the spirit of the name. They're kind of, you know, Black Knights and Black Arrows and da-da-da. They're kind of a little bit Blackadder names almost. They're kind of like a little bit reserved and restrained, whereas the US goes in for sort of, you know, Challengers and Eagles and Vanguards and all kinds of things like that. I mean, it's a difference in national ethos. And Russia goes in for names like Sputnik 1, translates as like friendly satellite, and Cosmos rocket. So it's sort of this big expansive vision. So I've always found that quite an interesting aspect of the UK space program, which also to me makes things slightly less memorable. I don't know if that's a valid argument, but it's easy to forget names like Black Arrow. It could be Robin Hood, you know, out in the forest. So I sometimes wonder if that's an aspect of how people, and well, might as well pick up here the names of the satellites, which were all Shakespeare's Tempest. Ariel, Prospero, there's another one I'm forgetting as well.
Puck. Ah, yes. Puck is the other one.
And they're very literary and cultural, which I like. I'm not saying I don't like it, but it's just an interesting difference with other national space programs.
I think you're onto something there, and I've always been fascinated by it, because this is, again, a good point that we can talk about throughout this. Is the big reason that Britain lost its space program is because the Treasury, as is always the case in Britain, the people who control the money, decided it was a waste of money and no one really wanted to stand up in Parliament and defend it. And I think what you say there really speaks to some of that. Something that both the Russians and the Americans always did very well was they having an evocative name for a program, adding an element of narrative and romance for a program, gives you a political hook on which to hang your hat to defend it if you want to defend it later. And the lack of that from the British program, that reservedness in namings, which are using the rainbow system from World War II, I think when you get to the point where the program's under threat, it becomes much harder to make a sort of national story around it, to make it a thing that we should preserve, a thing that we should keep going as a scheme, which France does very well until it joins the European Space Agency. France is very good at giving this going as a sort of, this is our national program, we should do it, in a way that Britain isn't. I mean, one of my favorite anecdotes is, I've seen accounts from American scientists who come over to Britain to learn about our rocketry during this period, because we are, at that point, the world experts in high-test peroxide rocketry. And they're coming over, and they arrive, and they're picked up in beaten-up old Morris miners by these rocket scientists from this base and driven there. And they're like, what the hell is this? You know, and they're like, oh, it's the only cars that we're allowed to buy. There's just perception and narrative matters. And I think you're right, is that as we move through the 50s into the 60s, the program continues, but it's always operating on this tiny budget. I mean, it's £3 million in terms of like 1970s that this is operating on, which is about £70 million today. That's nothing in terms of money.
No, it isn't. It really isn't. And I think I was talking before about Australia's motivations coming from that sense of betrayal. At this point too, I think Britain is getting a lot of this as well. I'll mention the ELDO program, the European Launcher Development Organization, which, well, I'll explain it first for listeners who don't know. So this was, everybody said, of course, this rocket was never going to succeed. The Blue Streak rocket was the first stage. The French Coralie rocket was the second stage. The West German Astris was the third stage. The satellite was built by Italy, and tracking and guidance is provided by Belgium and the Netherlands. So people joke, you know, of course it was never going to work trying to get all those nations to operate together. But it wasn't unsuccessful. I mean, it worked pretty well, except it didn't actually manage to launch a satellite. But it leads me, ELDO, the ELDO program, so Australia was a partner in this, and it was a precursor of the European Union. It was actually being used as a bit of a test to see how everybody would get on. And then, of course, ESA, is the European Space Agency, is the thing you get at the end. But one of my favourite stories from this stage is all of these different national teams were out staying at Woomera, and the rocket, I don't know if this is Blue Streak or which stage or whatever, but it's liquid oxygen fueled, and the French teams are out there smoking Gauloises on the launch pad. Now, I mean, that cannot be true. It cannot be true. Liquid oxygen is highly combustible, but that's the story. And there's lots of, you sort of go from this, it's Australia and the UK in it together. Then America comes along, lots of US testing there as well. Then suddenly everybody's there. And the Britain is just one of a number of new European nations. But if I can also, this isn't really a story, this is an experience, because the Blue Streak rocket is quite beautiful, really. It's a beautiful, you're nodding, I know you agree. It's like,
yeah, we'll for those watching, we'll get it on screen, and for those listening, check the show notes, because we'll get a link to a picture.
And I, of course, I knew what it looked like. There aren't any Blue Streaks in Australia. We might have those V2s. We don't have any Blue Streaks. Although at the RAF base Edinburgh, there is a Blue Streak hangar left, which I have seen. I went to Woomera, and you have to, if you're not driving, you catch a bus to Woomera that gets in at 2 a.m. So I was probably half asleep and whatever. I got off the bus and it stops outside the missile park where they have all models of all of these rockets. And I saw a Blue Streak, the very characteristic polished silver corrugations. There is a whole Blue Streak in the National Space Centre in Leicester. We want to see it. So I saw this Blue Streak and I sort of sleepily went to my hotel room. The hotel is the barracks where the national teams for the Europa Rockets stayed. So sort of that sense of history. And I woke up in the morning and I think I went to breakfast and said, oh, I saw the people like, no, there's no blue streak here. You didn't see a blue streak. But I was adamant that I had seen it and I dreamt it. And I don't know, I suppose it was so deep in my brain that my half awake 2 a.m. brain wanted to see the blue streak there. So my dream of the blue streak. But then, of course, eventually I did see the one that's at the National Space Center. So I was like, you know, having absolute conniptions of delight, which I suppose one shouldn't have looking at a intermediate range ballistic missile meant to deliver nuclear warheads. But as you say, it never had a nuclear warhead and fuel in it at the same time.
But I think this speaks, we've just talked about the lack of romance in the naming, but there is something very, very, let's call it sort of a dominion, include Britain in that, like rather than imperial, about all of this, which I think is, you've got these very iconic things, but they're not US, they don't look American, they don't look Soviet. This whole program is full of moments and people and objects that are beautiful or slightly silly in their own way, whilst also being absolute massive weapons of war. I mean, one of my favorite stories is RAF Spade Adam and various of the facilities related to this program are mostly in the middle of nowhere in tiny villages and everything else. And there's a fantastic story about Roy Domett, who's the chief missile officer for Britain throughout this entire period. He works on everything. And he is a keen Morris dancer, kind of classic British traditional folk dancing. And so many of these rocket scientists are, because what else is there to do in a tiny British when you're a man of a certain age in Britain at the time? But he's a legendary Morris dancer. He actually goes on to be one of the early historians of Morris. He's legendary for that as much as his missile work. Most of those Morris dancer friends don't know he's basically in charge of Britain's entire nuclear deterrent. But there's an amazing story. We could do so many, but I'll just do one about him, which is he once attends a Morris event, like a large festival for Morris dancing, and he goes along to it and he does it and everything else. He doesn't realize that actually it's a fundraising campaign for the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. So you've got Britain's chief rocket scientist dancing Morris at the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament's fundraising gathering. He basically gets spotted by the Secret Service, who are observing it, and called into the office at the Royal Aircraft Establishment the next day and told them, can you not do that, please? Like,
oh, that's hilarious.
But that's there's something very, very British and frankly very Australian and very French in the description of that, of these space programs. And what this does mean now, and all of this kind of comes together as we've talked about this, is you get the two civilian rockets around this. We've mentioned both of them already, are Black Knight and Black Arrow. And Black Knight is the really the one where they're saying, let's take the missile and let's turn it into a rocket. And then what you get with Black Arrow is this is the certain one where we say, okay, now we want to put our own satellites into geostationary orbit. And geostationary orbit's important as a milestone, isn't it?
Yeah. So in 1963, the first satellite, the US SINCOM 2, got to the geostationary region. So we're talking 35,648 kilometers above the surface of the Earth. And
well remembered.
Well, I've got somebody wrong, but it's above 35,000. At this altitude, a satellite orbits at the same rate as the Earth turns, so it can be stationary over any point in on Earth's surface. And the first people to predict the possibilities of this orbit were actually Konstantin Tsiolkovsky in Russia and Hermann Nordung in Vienna. And then Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction writer, same one, he knew about their work. So recent research has shown that he did actually know about their work. But he wrote a paper in 1945 for Wireless Times, I think it was called, that basically said, you could cover the entire Earth with just 3 geostationary satellites. So he flagged the importance of this orbit. This is where all the telecommunications satellites are, because obviously you can tune into them. So this, from 1963, it's just 6 years after the launch of Sputnik 1, they've got to launch so much further. It's so much further than low Earth orbit. They actually have to go, this is probably too boring to get into, but they have to go into transfer orbits and do all kinds of things. So suddenly there is having a launch path over the equator. And Woomera was too far south, really. There were many attempts to set up a launch site in Cape York, which is just below the equator. So you get the rotation of the Earth assisting to get something into orbit. But this was quite ambitious for the time. And it was also a recognition that geostationary orbit, geosynchronous and geostationary orbit, were where the future of space business kind of lay at that time. So it was quite a desirable piece of space real estate.
And I think as you've nicely summarized, it's a huge engineering and scientific milestone if you can reach it. And if you've got that, you have a launcher program that is going to be able to do communication satellites. You have the technology to do space as a business as much as space as a weapon of war. And Black Arrow is designed to try and achieve that. And remembering, listeners, that we've talked about how this is all operating on a tiny budget, that budget is shrinking every year by this point as the Treasury tightens the grip even further. And so ultimately we end up in a situation where 5 Black Arrows are built and we have a few dummy satellites and we have 2 functional sound broadcast satellites. As you mentioned the name of them earlier, we have Puck, and we will later have a second Puck that will be renamed to Prospero. If you want to describe the launches, some of the early launches, you can, or I can do it. It's entirely up to you.
I want to talk about how beautiful Prospero is. Well, okay, maybe that's all I need to say.
It 100%. I tell you what. You cover Prospero when we get to Prospero, because it is absolutely gorgeous. I do agree. What maybe actually, if you want to set the scene for us, because these rockets again are going to be launched from Australia. So I'll describe in a second how these launches go. But do you want to set the scene for us about what this would have looked and felt like at the launch site at the time?
Oh, gosh, that's because, do you know, I don't even know which launch area they were launched from, because they're inside the part of Woomera that is still classified. You can't go there. So I've seen some of the launch areas, but I haven't seen them. So I kind of don't. I don't have a clear sort of visual sense of what those launches would have looked like, except that, okay, well, let's talk in more general terms. So we're looking at red desert sand, where the launch, there were multiple different launch pads separated widely from each other, because, of course, you don't want an accident at one to affect an accident at the other. There was Woomera Township itself, but there were also little satellite towns closer to other launch pads, because things were being launched 24 hours a day. So people working on these launches quite likely stayed overnight in one of these little villages so that they were on hand during that time. There would have been a joint ground crew, Australian and British. And this is an interesting one, actually. I mean, you probably know more about this than me. For some of them, reporters were present, and I don't know if reporters were on the ground covering the launch. Is that something that's come up in your research?
I genuinely don't know. It's a really good question. It's one I'm going to go take away, I think, and look into, because now I think about it, I'd heard similar, but I've never really looked into whether they were present for these launches on site for them. So I think it's a really good question. I don't know. I think that's one I'll take away, and we can geek out on it. And once I work out whether they've
interestingly, I've been paddling around in the archives of the British Pathé News Service, and they've got lots of space stuff, and I sort of haven't thought to put these satellites in there to see what comes up, because it could well be, you know, they were news items in the UK and maybe they were news items in Australia as well. Maybe this was so, yeah. So I don't really know if they were celebrated in that kind of way at the time.
I mean, what you get definitely is there's a real sort of boys' own adventure about it. So I've got copies in shelves behind me somewhere of various things like, you know, your battle comic or your Dan Dare type comics or things that would have like an insert in them that's like, here's a cutaway diagram of a black prince, here's a cutaway diagram of a black arrow. And those are gorgeous works of art and they're amazing things. So there's an element of that cultural thing that's coming through. I mean, before we wax lyrical about Prospero, I'll set you up for Prospero by describing the path to Prospero. So listeners, remember we've talked that there are five of these rockets have been made. There are a few dummy satellites. And then we have, at this stage, two satellites, two functional basic communication satellites, basically at this stage called Puck 1 and Puck 2. So the first launch of the first Black Arrow happens in June 1969. And actually, it doesn't go well. There's an electrical issue on the pad and it launches, but it goes out of control. And it has to be exploded by the range operator. And one of the favorite quotes I've found about this is from the range operator himself, who, whilst everyone else is getting really disappointed that this rocket has failed, he's legitimately excited because he gets to push the button that blows up a rocket. He's never gotten to push the button that blows up the rocket before.
Who would not be excited by that?
Yeah, just maybe don't try not to look excited about it in front of the scientists and engineers who are really depressed. The second launch, they fix it, they find the fault, and this launches successfully in March 1970. And the goal with this is to test the first two stages, because this is a rocket that's composed of three stages, and they're all British built in this one. They've been assembled in Warwickshire, I think, most of the parts for this. But this is a successful launch. So two of our five Black Arrows have now launched, and those ones had dummy satellites. Now, even at this point, and we're heading into the middle of 1970, we start to get rumors that the whole program is on the verge of being cancelled by the Treasury. And what happens is they decide at this point they can't really afford to wait. They can't really afford to hold off anymore. They need to start trying to get these satellites into orbit. So they gamble, and they gamble by deciding to launch the first of their functional satellites, Puck 1. And so they launch that at the same time as they're testing the third stage. And unfortunately, this goes wrong. There's a leak in the second stage. It fails to ignite and it makes it into space, but it doesn't reach the geostationary orbit and it falls to the ground. And this happens in September 1970, right at the beginning of the month. And then literally the day later, on September the 2nd, 1971, the British space program, they get the word that it's probably cancelled and that this is it. They've still got those two rockets left, but it's cancelled. But as you described earlier, the involvement, the process of this is you've got to get the rockets to Australia. And Black Arrow 4 and the final satellite are already en route to Australia. And the scientists and engineers persuade the Treasury that it would be cheaper to launch it than it would be to pack it all up and bring it back. So they are going to have one final shot at getting this rocket into space. And to do that, they're going to launch their last satellite, which was called Puck 2 at that point. They now, in that fit of Shakespearean melodrama, decide to rename that satellite Prospero, that kind of the magician stranded on an island, the last of his kind, all of this thing. It's very dramatic. It's very, very, very literary. But yeah, Alice, describe Prospero for the listeners, because she, I think satellites are she's, she is beautiful.
Absolutely beautiful. I don't know if they're she. I don't call them she.
I think they're she's.
Well, I think we should abandon that because it's like ships and there's a whole lot of cultural stuff that goes along with
that. Well, let's go with they. So describe Prospero. Because they are beautiful.
Prospero is like a subconical flattened sphere and it has solar panels on it, but the solar panels are arranged as if it were... It's almost like one of those really complex geometric Arab paintings or tile works. So the geometry of it is kind of beautiful. It's got a patterned surface. It's And it's, so if you take a flattened sphere, take a sphere and squish it, and then smooth the sides out so that they're flat and make the center of it flat. I'm describing this terribly. Put on these gorgeous solar panels and then stick on some little antennas and legs at both ends. So it's got them at both ends of the satellite. And there's a model of it in the Science Museum in London, so you can go and see it. And it's gorgeous. It's really gorgeous. And it's very different. So these days, satellites launched into the geostationary ring, they're like a box, and they've got two long wings, two long solar panel wings. So it's very different. And they're cookie cutter. They're not that interesting. They're all the same as each other. Whereas Prospero is I don't know, if you took the brain of Prospero, the magician on the island, out and made it into a satellite with thoughts going all over the place, and then you launched it, then that's what Prospero would be like. What a terrible description.
I many years ago. I think it's a good description. The tile, I think the thing, listeners, to hold into your mind is as Alice described it, that the solar panels on this, they're not what you expect, like when you think of a satellite with solar panels. As you, I think you really nicely summed it up by saying, imagine those kind of beautiful, the beautiful almost tiled bathroom you might see in a sultan's palace in Istanbul. They almost feel, that's what they feel like, even if it doesn't, maybe not the most visually accurate description, but in feel, that's what it feels like. And I was chatting many years ago in a pub with a very old British rocket scientist, again, who did Morris. That's how I bumped into him at a Morris dancing thing. And it's that kind of thing. There was a period if I was in villages and there was Morris dancing on at the time, I'd always turn around and just casually ask if anyone was involved in British rocketry, because 9 times out of 10, someone would go, oh, yeah, no, old Cyril over in the back there. Yeah, Cyril did that.
Oh, my God.
I was chatting to him and I thought he summed this up, because I mentioned to him, like, Prospero is lovely. It's a work of engineering art and it looks very different. And he said, yeah, well, we're a nation who built Spitfires. Of course we were going to make beautiful satellites.
Oh, wow.
And I just thought that was the most really capturing that kind of thing of, like,
wow.
It's not form matters. There's a sort of William Morrisness to it.
Oh,
like, I really like that.
That is perfect. There is a sort of William Morrisness to it. And I think these aesthetic differences between different countries and different rocket traditions are, you know, this is about culture. This isn't about engineering or technology. I mean, it is a bit, obviously, but it's also about culture. There are many ways to make a satellite. Not everybody makes a beautiful one. And I think that is something that really, for me, distinguishes Prospero.
So let's talk about the final attempt here. They know they've got this Black Arrow 4. This is going to be their last attempt. They're not going to be allowed, whatever happens, they're not going to be able to allow to launch Black Arrow 5. And this is their last satellite anyway. And remember, listeners, at this point, they've not successfully managed to reach the orbit. The last attempt failed and took with it one of their last two satellites. So there's accounts that almost the entirety of the team ends up in Australia for this, because everyone knows it's the last chance. This is the last hurrah. The program is effectively on the verge of being cancelled. They've been already informed it will be cancelled. And so effectively, they head there. And on the 28th of October, 1971, they're in place. They're ready to go. And they decide that they're going to try and launch this. Now, they'd actually tried to launch it the day before on the 27th of October, but the weather conditions changed. And I'm going to bow to you on the Australian experience to describe what this scene might have looked like. But effectively, they have to not launch it because of the weather. And you get this, all these British unhappy scientists end up back in one of those small villages, like you say, and they end up in a small bar. They end up in the bar in the place. And while they're there, one of the locals makes the mistake of saying, oh, what's the matter, boys? Did your matches get wet? And a massive bar fight kicks off between everyone. So you can probably picture all that scene better than I can. But I just think that's fascinating. It's that example of the interactions between those communities.
I think, yeah, you've got a little niggling thing there, a little bit of argy-bargy just waiting to burst out. And it's not as if, I mean, Australia had no skin in the game at this point in terms of satellite launch. I mean, we'd launched ReSat 1 in 1967, and it was a US rocket that had been given to us, and we hadn't actually launched a satellite since. So it was kind of like, okay, done it once, now let's see the POMs try. So I can just imagine that little opportunity to have a little dig in there, and a willingness to take the consequences of the fisticuffs that ensued. I can absolutely imagine that.
So 28th of October, this is their last chance, and they decide they're going to try again. The weather is fine. They can launch. This has never succeeded before. And at 3:50 a.m., they in GMT, actually, so in UK time, they fire this rocket. And the first stage fires 10 seconds later on that, as you described it, that this looks like a tube of lipstick. It's almost moving into the air on the site on a pillar of nothing, because this is superheated steam. It leaps into the air. And at 3:53, the first stage separates perfectly. And the second stage fires. And it's looking good. At 3:55 a.m., the third stage separates. And this is the bit that had failed before. And it fires. It fires successfully. And this third stage was codenamed Waxwing. And it's now leaping up and heading towards that last milestone, that huge milestone that you said, geosynchronous, geostationary orbit. And a few minutes later, it reaches that point and the front of Waxwing opens, that third stage opens, and Prospero starts to float out. And as it does, based on the signals they received back, they realize that Prospero has bumped into the opening as she leaves. And there's no signal from her for some time. And the descriptions I've heard of just everyone thinks they don't know if she's going to work. They don't know if she's going to fire. And then after a nervous control room wait, people literally say they just nobody was breathing. And then the satellite starts to sing and they pick up the sound of her. And listeners, I think at this point, we're just going to pause and I'm going to play you what that sounded like. And yeah, down on Earth, the people hearing that same noise, the combination, as Alice described, of the Australian engineers, the British engineers, this sort of imperial almost program, this Dominion program, they all just break into absolute joy and cheers. And then a few hours later, the word comes through, the entire program is cancelled.
When I think of things like this, because of course Blue Streak got cancelled too, it wasn't just the huge disappointment to, I mean, it's broader than just the space. It's like the aeronautics and astronautics, all of that industry, who are all collaborating on this technology, just the disappointment, the success and then the disappointment. And it was the same for Australia as well. It meant the joint program that had been set up, this whole infrastructure from the 40s, was on its way out. And at this time also, well, actually earlier than this, so France had decided to set up its launch site in Kourou in French Guiana, which is now the sort of primary European Space Agency launch site. So then France had pulled out of the whole ELDO program by 60 something or other, leaving Britain stranded a little bit. And it seems so typical. It's sort of in very broad brushstrokes. You think of that Dominion thing, that empire thing. And I, as an Australian, obviously I'm not a fan of that. But in terms of the sort of ambition and ethos, you'll come back to this thing where the penny-pinching people within the exchequer or whatever, I'm sorry, I can't remember what it's called, but that...
Yeah, the joy is the treasury.
Yeah, so where's that ambition? Everybody else in the world, France is doing it, Germany isn't because they have restrictions, obviously. USSR is doing it, US is doing it. You know, Australia had its side hustle at Woomera as well. And suddenly on with success, you know, on the back of success, suddenly Britain doesn't want to do space anymore. And in a sense, you know, Australia and Britain have followed a similar path then. Australians don't know that Woomera was the busiest launch range in the world in the 1960s. They don't know that we launched a satellite. They don't know that we had our own rockets. We only got a space agency in 2018. And the UK reignited its space ambitions. You would remember the year, but you know, this is after doing nothing for a long, long time. The UK Space Agency and everything that is happening there is also fairly recent, also being shut down at the moment. The path has been ceded to the US and USSR, the European Space Agency as well, and now the private corporations. But this is where it comes from. This is the foundation upon which both Australian and British sort of space ambitions is established. And it's curious for sort of political and social reasons why this was just not seen as an important thing to do.
And I think it, as you say, like as you moved into the 90s and industry changed and focus has changed, it became clear that actually it was a mistake. And I think even the Treasury would have admitted it was a mistake and the political side of things admitted it was a mistake. But it was just this it's one of those short-term decisions that just has a real sad and long-term cost. But I mean, we'll talk a bit more in the extra bit about various aspects, particularly around the archaeology side of space. I'm really fascinated by that. So I really want to dig into that with you. But I mean, Prospero's still up there. Prospero's still orbiting. Like you can still, if you open up your little tracking things, I always say to people, like, open up a little tracking app, a little web link. We'll put one in the reading notes. But like, you can tell when she passes overhead wherever you are in the world, and you can just give her a wave. I think she's still up there. She broadcasted for decades, and the tracking station, General RAF tracking station at RAF Lasham, used to fire her up every year on her birthday. They'd send her a message and say, "We still know you're up there," basically. And the satellite would sing back. But yeah, like they tried to restart her for her 40th, the satellite for her 40th birthday, but they just failed. They'd lost the launch codes because when RAF Lasham shut down, nobody bothered to sit there and record all the technical documentation on how to activate this satellite. And that's almost archaeological loss that we get in, you know, of just technical documentation was not seen as important. The instruction codes were not. And I forget which university it was that tried to work out how to reactivate her in 2011, but they never managed. But
the Mullard Space Science Lab. So what are they part of? It was Mullard, yeah. And I did actually meet a couple of them. They'd also run out of funding and, you know, people had finished their PhDs and moved on. So maybe with more time and resources, they could have continued to search for those codes. And I think you make such an important point there because people often say to me, why is what you're doing archaeology? Why isn't it just history? Because we've got all the documents. You don't need to. And I'm like, no, well, we do not.
Let's dig into that in a second. But before we do, for regular listeners, I just want to really take this opportunity to make sure, A, to say thank you for you to coming on, because this is why I wanted to have this chat with you. But also, as where can people, we mentioned book at the beginning, where can people find you, read your work, learn more about this before we talk a bit more about the extra bit?
If people are interested in space archaeology and also perspectives of Australian coming to all these kinds of history. So I have a book, Dr. Space Junk versus the Universe, which the MIT Press edition, I think, is available in the UK and Europe and the US. I'm sold out in Australia, New Zealand, just, you know, dropping that in. I also have a blog called Space Age Archaeology, and I often write stuff that I'm currently working on. A lot of it is not archaeology as such, but other things, so people can go and have a look at that. Online, you'll find various things. I gave a TED talk in 2013, which is sort of a summary of the field of space archaeology, and various other talks covering different aspects of it since then. So, yes, would be delighted if people wanted to go out and find out more. about space archaeology.
And you can also find Alice on Blue Sky. I will mention that.
I'm Dr. Space Junk on Blue Sky. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Well, as Alice has hinted at, and as my fluffy research assistant has just arrived. So regular listeners, thank you very much for joining us. People who are subscribed via the Untitled History, untitled-history.com, don't forget that you get advertless versions of this show. You get the extended version, including the chat we're about to have, and lots of other little extra bits. And if you have enjoyed this podcast, please do rate us on the platform that you are using. It makes a genuine difference in getting us into feeds. But also just tell a friend on WhatsApp, tell someone that you know would like this. And word of mouth is everything, and it's how these things grow. So thanks to listening, regular listeners. And if you're an extra listener, hang around and stay tuned for some more content. You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, why not head over to our dedicated supporter page? There, for the cost of a cup of tea, you can decide which subjects we cover next, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and join a community of like-minded people. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. So welcome, listeners, to the extra bit. The fluffy research assistant is fluffy research assistanting. So be aware, if you're watching this, you may see some tail swishes on the screen. But Alice, space archaeology, you are one of the founders of this as a field, really. And I just, tell us a bit more about it.
Well, I suppose the thing that people are most puzzled by initially is like, how archaeology is the deep past, ancient stuff. How do you have an archaeology of space? That's right now. It's recent. How does that happen? And the reason it happens is because archaeology isn't actually about old stuff. I mean, a lot of it obviously is. Archaeology is actually about how humans interact with the material world. So that means it doesn't matter when it is or even where it is, you can still do an archaeological study. And coming back to the point of, you know, when we lack documents about so many things, and even if you have those documents, people aren't sitting around thinking, what will somebody in 50 years like to know? They don't write this stuff down. There's missing information, and what we do is look at the objects and the places. What stories do they tell? And sometimes how does that differ from the documentary record? Because sometimes it does. It's what you find when you look at the object is not what's described or even...
You have been listening to the extra bit on the Untitled History Podcast. If what you have heard there is a thing you want to hear more of, then I'm sorry it faded out, but what you will have to do is back us, and then you can find out more. So don't forget to back us at theuntitled-history.com for more of what you've heard here and more extra episodes in future. Oh, sorry, hang on. I can hear a cat yowling, so I need to go let a cat out. And then just start from your... I want to say here about names, but again, so 2 seconds, sorry.